a lot of things that have happened over the course of the last 15 or 20 years in the NBA are kind of strange, and when you throw them all together, you know, you really have to sit back and say, how can this all happen? The veteran referees would tell me that if Michael Jordan goes to the basket and it's in a crowd and he misses a shot and you're not sure what happened, that you need to blow the whistle and call a foul because, you know, he's not going to miss too often. He must have been fouled. I focus on the pain, the only thing that's real. Obviously, they didn't think that somebody like myself would become addicted and cross that line that you know, nobody should be near. And unfortunately for me and for the league, you know, that's what happened. Try to kill it all away, but I remember everything. My attorney actually spoke to the United States attorney, and he basically just told my attorney to give me a message, and that message was that he knew what I did and when I did it and who I did it with, and it was just a matter of time before they came and got me, and I was much better off losing my job rather than losing my job for a long, long time. And you could have it all. You know, even to this day, you know, I get an enormous amount of requests for interviews in regard to the story about what I did and how I did it.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, Banal of America Audio with your host, Tim Banal.
What is going on, my friends? This is Tim Banal of banalofamerica.com. Another edition of BOA Audio Season 5, coming at you this week here with the first installment of the final four of Season 5 for A-list superstar guests lined up for you here as we close the book on our fifth season of BOA Audio. I know we got a lot of folks out there who are first-time listeners to the program, and they are checking out the show specifically for our guest here this week, former NBA referee Tim Donaghy. I want to welcome all those new listeners. I hope you check out the program beyond just this episode. If you're into the paranormal, if you're into high strangeness, this is the show for you. We've got over 130 episodes in our archive. So if you have even a passing interest in the paranormal, stick around, dig into the BOA Audio Archive. We'd love to have you as part of our listening audience. I'm not going to spend a whole lot of time here at the beginning of the show pitching the hardcore BOA Audio listeners to try this episode. But I will say, trust me, folks, this is way beyond merely a sports episode of the program. This is a serious conspiracy theory that we're going to be talking about here with Tim Donaghy, and it is truly an enlightening conversation. So often on this program, we've talked to a lot of people that allege a variety of different conspiracies, ranging from the plausible to the simply insane. And here on this program this week with Tim Donaghy, we're talking about something that is a little bit more down to earth, but at the same time, something that is truly massive, and that is the potential conspiracy behind the scenes in the NBA to favor certain players, certain teams, and hold sway over the outcomes of certain games. I'm going to break from tradition here a little bit and just give you sort of a short bio on Tim Donaghy here before I give you the thumbnail look at what we're going to be talking about for the folks who are unfamiliar with Tim Donaghy. He is a former professional basketball referee who worked in the NBA for 13 seasons from 1994 to 2007. During his career in the NBA, he officiated 772 regular season games and 20 playoff games. In the summer of 2007, he resigned from his position in the league just before reports surfaced that he was being investigated by the FBI for allegations that he bet on games he officiated during the previous two seasons. This story, of course, became a worldwide headline-making story as it exploded into the media. Eventually, Donaghy pled guilty to two federal charges related to the investigation, served more than a year in federal prison for his crimes, In December of 2009, he wrote the book Personal Foul, a first-person account of the scandal that rocked the NBA, in which he details how this whole story happened and his role in the betting scandal that shocked the sports world. Chances are, if you are a news junkie, you've heard of Tim Donaghy and his story. I'm almost certain that if you're a sports fan, you've definitely heard of Tim Donaghy and the scandal that erupted surrounding his deeds. So here this week on BOA Audio, we are going to really get to the bottom of the whole tale with former NBA referee Tim Donaghy. Let me give you a short thumbnail look at what we're going to be talking about here in this conversation. First of all, it is jam-packed. Obviously, we're going to cover his story, how it all started. We'll find out how he evaded an earlier NBA investigation into his gambling habits. We'll really dig into the proverbial game within the game, where relationships between referees and players, coaches, and owners can hold sway over how a game unfolds. We'll find out about the unspoken edict of preferential treatment for star players in large cities, and we'll get stories from Donaghy about his interaction with a plethora of NBA stars, including Shaquille O'Neal, Charles Barkley, Kobe Bryant, Michael Jordan, and LeBron James, as well as coaches like Phil Jackson and George Karl. Plus, we'll delve into famous incidents like the Malice at the Palace riot, where Donaghy was one of the referees, his off-the-court run-in with Rasheed Wallace, other NBA conspiracy theories, how female referees ended up in the game, and, of course, just tons and tons more. That's really just a tiny scratch at the surface of what we're going to be talking about here. Altogether, it really is a stunningly revealing edition of the program, which takes you behind the scenes of a multi-million dollar sports entertainment industry and pulls back the curtain on what's really going on in the NBA with a man who has seen it backstage and on the court, former NBA referee Tim Donaghy. I've already given you the bio for Tim Donaghy, so there is not much else left to say here at the beginning of the program. You definitely want to check out his book, Personal Foul, a first-person account of the scandal that rocked the NBA. You can find that via Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and most likely at your local bookstores. So without any further ado, let's get down to business and rock and roll. This interview was recorded on July 23rd, 2010. Tim Donaghy talking about the NBA betting scandal that rocked the sports world on BOA Audio Season 5. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another edition of Banal of America Audio. Very excited about this interview. Our guest is former NBA referee Tim Donaghy, and he, of course, for those folks who are unfamiliar with him, was involved in really just a huge, massive, worldwide headline story. About 3 years ago, really, is when it all burst into the news cycle, and he was involved in a betting scandal in the NBA. Served some time in jail as a result of his actions, and then wrote the book Personal Foul, a first-person account of the scandal that rocked the NBA, and appeared on 60 Minutes, and did a whole bunch of media appearances talking about it. Now he's here on BOA Audio to discuss his amazing story and to give us a behind-the-scenes look at what's really going on in the NBA. And I know a lot of folks listening are BOA Audio listeners, and they're sort of like, what are you doing a sports show for, man? I already get grief for the baseball episode. But really, you know, here on the program, we focus on a lot of times UFOs and conspiracies and stuff like that, and we very rarely, if ever, I don't think we ever have, had someone who was on the inside of these sort of stories. But here with Tim Donaghy, we've got someone who really was right there in the mix. I mean, he refereed some major NBA basketball games, had interaction with all the biggest stars in the NBA, and really understands the culture of what's really going on. So we've got a true insider here. So Tim Donaghy, welcome to the program. It's a real thrill to have you on the show.
I appreciate it. Thanks for having me.
And I got to put over your book, dude. It was riveting. I mean, I read it over the course of a couple days. I just could not put it down. I just thought it was just outstanding, and kudos to you to be brave enough to put it all out there. I mean, you know, I could see how you might want this all just to go away and for you to fade into the background, but you're still out there and you're still making a lot of appearances and stuff, and of course you're on Facebook and you're working on the website timdonaghy.com. So You know, kudos to you for at least sticking it out and dealing with the slings and arrows of the media, who I'm sure are still kind of looking to take some shots at you here and there.
Yeah, they do, but it was a situation where I certainly wanted to let everybody know what I did and how I actually did it. And, you know, I was actually highly encouraged by not only friends and family, but by law enforcement officials to write the book. So, you know, it was a situation where I think people were getting the wrong idea about how I was able to do what I did and what I actually did. So I wanted to make sure that it was put out there along with, you know, many of the mistakes I made so that it was a learning experience for everybody.
Absolutely. Yeah, for sure. You know, to start it out, I guess, so let's do a sort of like a thumbnail here on your story for people who are unfamiliar with Tim Donaghy and your saga of the last few years. I'll give a sort of brief thumbnail and you can sort of flesh it out for me. How's that sound?
Sure.
Okay. You were an NBA referee for 13 years. And over the course of, you know, your lifetime, you sort of developed this gambling addiction and it got progressively worse. And then you sort of held back on betting on the NBA games until around November of 2003, and then you sort of decided you were going to start betting on these games because it seemed so easy to call the games based on all the inside information you had. And that sort of happened sporadically over the course of the next 3 years, and then around the same time frame, November of 2006, ironically enough, a couple of dudes you knew from high school, you know, you think this sort of house of cards would come tumbling down with some, you know, serious heavy hitters, but really it's strange that, you know, two guys you knew from high school ended up causing all this sort of to culminate. But they sort of strong-armed you into making picks that got funneled to some criminal elements, and that went on for about 6 months, and then in the spring, summer of 2007, it all came to a head when the FBI started investigating the whole thing, and then you turned yourself into the FBI and you know, played ball with them to let them know what really happened. That's a pretty good description of your story, right?
It is. It certainly is. It was a situation where I was, you know, addicted to gambling, and I was making bets on many different occasions, and I crossed the line, like you said, and started betting on NBA games, and, you know, the word had trickled down to some people that it shouldn't have, and basically when I wanted to stop betting, you know, these individuals picked me up and basically threatened to expose me to the NBA or worse yet, have somebody visit my wife and kids in Florida. And they wanted to continue to be able to get these picks. So, you know, because of the poor choices I had made in the past, I felt that I was put in a box and was hoping to just provide these picks for them for a period of time till the end of the regular season and hopefully be released. And that would be the end of it and never do it again. But unfortunately, that's not the way it played out. And it put me and my family in a very difficult situation that, you know, is certainly leaving us struggling even today.
Oh, yeah, for sure. I mean, this thing cost you everything. You know, I'm sure it just it's just been tremendously difficult to go through, even though it was a situation of your own doing, you know. But you take responsibility for that, and I respect that. So, you know, I'm not here to say to judge you or anything like that, and it always makes me feel uncomfortable just hearing the descriptions of you as, like, disgraced, like, referee. I don't really feel the right to call you disgraced, dude. I mean, that's not my – I'm not here to do that, so.
No, it's something I think that I was just tagged with early on, and it's a headline that everybody runs with. You know, but unfortunately, when I have to look in the mirror every day, I have to accept that because of the poor choices that I made, and at some point – I hope that by sharing my story with many other people that they realized how important choices are that we all have to make and how making the right ones are so important and maybe that tag at some time will, you know, be lifted.
Let's hope so, yeah. I thought it was interesting that you note in the book that the NBA sort of was looking at you for gambling like way before all this sort of happened because of a incident with your neighbor who sort of like tipped them off to your penchant for going to casinos and stuff like that. So, I mean, this all could have happened, you know, this all could have had a completely different turn of events if they had further investigated it back in the day. Do you think they just sort of, in their minds, it was just sort of like, you know, well, he's doing some innocuous gambling, but he's not directly involved in gambling on the NBA, so we'll just sort of like look the other way on it?
I think that's exactly what happened. It was a situation where, you know, many of the referees gambled on many different things, and they were aware of that. And the little investigation that they did, that they found out that I gambled on golf or, you know, that I had gone to a casino on occasion is something that many other referees had done. So it was really, in their mind, not a big deal, even though in the contract we weren't supposed to place a bet of any kind. So I think it was something where they just looked the other way, not realizing that it had escalated into a point where I was betting on professional sporting events.
Yeah, and one of the big points you make in the book is this whole issue of fixing games. And it seems like it's been portrayed in the media that you were fixing games, but you contend that this is incorrect and that you were basically making your picks based on the inside information that you had. So explain that so we can sort of like clear that whole, you know, misconception up for people that think you were just out there fixing games.
Right. Well, first of all, I mean, I think it's very important that you said you read the book, that the FBI said that I told the truth, and, you know, they invested the whole situation for game fixing, and at no time did I go out there and put a Shaquille O'Neal or Dwayne Wade or Kobe Bryant to the bench with, you know, phantom fouls to make sure that a bet would win. You know, there were times where I did stick at the players, just like all the referees did, you know, if they had done something in a previous game or, you know, we wanted to get even with them for, you know, a certain situation. And, you know, what I did was is I made picks based on relationships, positive and negative relationships that existed between referees and players, referees and coaches, and referees and owners. And what I would do is I would create my own betting line on the game and look in the newspaper and see what the betting line was. And if there was a difference between 4 or 5 points, I would, you know, tell people to bet the games. And, you know, the bottom line is that at times there were meetings and memos that were passed down from the NBA office on what to call and how to call it in a lot of these games. And I also used that information, you know, to create a line and to place an enormous amount of winning bets on NBA games.
Yeah. In the book, you say it's like you had about a 70 to 80% hit rate, which is pretty you know, that's like remarkable for gambling. So it's clearly you knew what was going on.
Exactly. And, you know, the whole situation unfolded because people associated with organized crime were being funneled millions of dollars. And, you know, usually the FBI doesn't get involved in gambling situations with organized crime. But because of the amount of money that was being funneled to them, it was something that they started to look into. And that's how they basically backtraced it to realize that I was actually a part of it.
And sort of like along the lines of there about this inside information that you had, you say in the book that when the refs make up their mind about a game, sort of like before the game, you know, they have their opinion on who's going to win, it often turns into a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Yeah, there's no doubt about it. There was definitely trends and things that I would pick up on, you know, that referees would discuss at lunchtime or in pregame meetings. And I would take that information knowing that a certain team was going to be put at an advantage and another team was going to be put at a disadvantage. And I used that information again to, like you said, place an enormous amount of winning bets on games.
One thing that I really appreciated in the book was sort of that you give credence to the idea that's sort of been around forever, I guess, or at least for the last couple decades here, is that the NBA really is a superstars league where the rules are sort of different for the stars than they are for the role players and stuff like that. I guess talk a little bit about that culture of, you know, protecting the superstar players.
There's definitely a culture in the NBA to where certain players play by a different set of rules. When you talk about a Michael Jordan or a Kobe Bryant or a Dwayne Wade, you know, they're going to get calls to the basket that, you know, a seventh, eighth, or ninth man on a team is certainly not going to get. And, you know, I like to give the example that when I first came into the league, that the veteran referees would tell me that if Michael Jordan goes to the basket and it's in a crowd and he misses a shot and you're not sure what happened, that you need to blow the whistle and call a foul because, you know, he's not going to miss too often. He must have been fouled. So, you know, it was a situation where they certainly trained and programmed the referees to give a lot of these stars preferential treatment.
There's always the contention, too, that the NBA wants certain cities to keep advancing in the playoffs and, you know, like the LAs and the Bostons and stuff like that. You know, how pervasive did you see that sort of thing going on?
Yeah, I saw that many times because what happens is you know, the referees are put in a meeting before these playoff games take place at about 11 a.m. And, you know, they go over game film and they show a certain place that they want called, you know, that night, and they show you certain plays that were missed in previous games that they don't want called. And it just seemed to me that I was able to pick up on trends to where certain teams were being favored on certain given nights, and it was a lot of times it was favoring some of these big market teams, and teams were put in an advantage, and certainly other teams were put at a disadvantage, and I was able to pick up on that, and I don't think it's any secret along the lines of star treatment that some of these big market teams get the benefit of some of these calls.
Now, obviously, you noticed this and picked up on it. Was it something that was, like, openly discussed amongst the other referees, or was it just sort of like this unwritten rule or unspoken agreement that, you know, superstar players get the advantages and you know, superstar cities get the advantages, if you will?
Openly discussed amongst referees and even group supervisors from the league office. So this is not anything that was a major secret, and it was something that, you know, within my cooperation with the FBI, that this was openly discussed, and through their investigation, they were also able to confirm that this was done, and I think that they put the NBA on notice that you know, they were well aware that this was taking place, and basically to stop it in no uncertain terms, and that you know, information was passed along to me that, you know, there were going to be massive changes within the NBA.
Interesting. Okay. One guy, one of your colleagues that sort of is a recurring player in the book as far as, you know, you sharing stories about how predictable his biases were, how predictable, you know, his effect on the games was Dick Bavetta. So I guess talk a little bit about him and, you know, what you observed as far as his style of refereeing, let's say.
You know, Dick Bavetta was one of those people that, you know, was in the league many, many years, and he was somebody that when you know, the score became lopsided in a game, would favor the team that was down in the game to actually allow them to save some embarrassment and bring it closer together for TV viewership. He was also one of those guys that, you know, refereed playoff series and gave the advantage to the calls to the team that was down in the series, because he knew moving forward that if they would win, it would just mean another game in that playoff series, which would mean millions of dollars you know, to the NBA and to the teams. And he was somebody that openly discussed that, not only with me, but other referees, and other referees discussed what he had done. And it was a style that existed that other referees also used. So he was the main guy that, you know, taught some of the younger referees the philosophies of what he used.
When you were writing the book and everything, did you feel like, I guess, conflicted, or how'd you feel about sort of calling out your, you know, former colleagues and stuff like that in the book? Because, I mean, I would feel kind of like I would want to protect them or something, but you didn't seem to pull any punches as far as, you know, saying, you know, describing some of their tendencies and stuff like that.
Well, I can tell you that I was certainly conflicted about naming names, and when I first sought out to do it, I tried to, you know, do it without naming names, but it you know, people and the NBA fans deserve to know, you know, what actually was done and how it was done. And I think if I tried to hide the fact that, you know, certain referees did certain things, I wasn't putting it all out there. And I wanted to give it a true and accurate account with obvious examples so that, you know, my point hit home and there was no misunderstanding. And I think, you know, it was something where I certainly didn't want to throw other people under the bus. But, you know, I think that, you know, with the way the whole story was handled, I wanted to give everybody a, certainly an accurate account and, you know, give certain examples so that there was no misunderstanding.
While we're on the Dick Bavetta angle of this all thing, let's talk about the Game 6 of the 2002 Western Conference Finals, which seems to be, you know, the most cited game as far as some chicanery going on, and that was between the Lakers and the Sacramento Kings. I guess tell that story and talk a little bit about what you think really went down there.
Well, I mean, obviously that's a pivotal game in the series. Dick Bavetta was refereeing it, and again, his philosophy was to favor the team that was down in the series, you know, to force a Game 7. And it was a situation where L.A. needed a win, and obviously they got the benefit of an enormous amount of calls in that game, and a Game 7 was forced. So it was one of the situations where it was very obvious that calls that should have went in Sacramento's favor certainly did not, and some strange things happened that forced a Game 7 and actually changed the history of sports, because that year LA went on to win the championship, and I think Sacramento certainly had the best team in the league and would have closed out LA in that infamous game six and went on to win the championship that year.
Yeah, so it's almost like a situation where they want to extend the series and then it has this whole butterfly effect of what happens after that.
Sure it does, and not only that, but it's a situation where, LA's a big market team and it's great for them to be in the finals versus Sacramento. I think that was also, a situation that helped the league. And unfortunately for Sacramento, I've said this publicly before, I think that they should have a championship ring on their finger for that year, and unfortunately they don't.
Now, you said that you made a lot of your predictions obviously based on certain referees' biases and stuff like that, dislike of certain players and coaches and owners. How did you keep your biases in check when you were a referee, and, did you ever let those biases, affect your judgment during the games?
I think when you talk about, the biases and what takes place in the NBA games or situations where you don't want to go out and just flat out make up calls against certain individuals, but I think you make sure you don't let anything slide when they're involved, and I think you have somewhat of a quicker trigger when it comes to technical fouls on those type of players. So I think it's something where every referee in the league, especially referees that have 10 or more years in the league, have both positive and negative relationships that exist within the league, and I took those relationships and I used them to place winning bets on the games.
Now we'll get to Rasheed Wallace in a little bit. I'm a big Rasheed fan for his antics, but obviously when I read your book, I was surprised that he had a story of his own involving you. But were there certain players, that you had particularly good relationships with before we sort of get into the negative aspects?
I mean, there are always players. I mean, certain players are much more professional than other players. And I'll give you an example of David Robinson. He's just somebody that is a true professional. And when it comes to him, obviously you don't want to be in a situation where you screw a guy over like that and miss a call. So, it's a positive and a negative relationship. Maybe some players aren't going to get those marginal calls, but somebody like David Robinson is because of how professional and kind he is towards the referees on most given nights.
Yeah. So it's like if you're cool with the referees, if you don't give them a hard time, when you get calls against you and stuff like that, they'll give you the benefit of the doubt later on down the line, sort of thing.
Yeah, no doubt about it. And some guys that, just want to play that jerk role are put in a situation where, they're not going to get the benefit of the doubt. And, it happens on a nightly basis.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the Rasheed Wallace thing, because I was stunned by this whole aspect of your story, because I always found Rasheed Wallace to be pretty entertaining for his antics. And then I read your book and was like stunned by what happened with that whole thing. So I guess share the story of your run-in with Rasheed Wallace after the game and what happened there.
It was a situation where during the game he threw the ball at one of our other referees after a foul was called. And, I asked him not to throw the ball at him, and he cursed at me, and I gave him a technical foul. And he felt that he didn't deserve the technical foul. Portland ended up winning the game by like 20 points, and I think he had, one of the best games of the year. And he just waited for me outside in the parking lot and started to scream and curse at me. And I said something back to him, and he actually wanted to fight me and rushed me and, was ready to knock my teeth down my throat. And fortunately for me, some people grabbed him at the last minute before he was able to do so. And he was given a pretty hefty fine and suspension because of it.
What's it like out there when you make a call against a guy? What do they usually say to you? Because obviously we can't hear it when we're watching on TV, but like what's the interaction like between the players and the referees, when all that kind of stuff's going down as far as giving fouls to people and stuff?
I mean, they're calling you every name in the book if they're disagreeing with you, and it's a situation where as a referee you have to earn some respect so they're not continually yelling, screaming, and cursing at you, because once you allow one player to do it, the other players start to do it. So, you have to basically draw a line in the sand and gain your respect, or else, you're not going to have any, and the game's going to be chaos. So, there's players like Rasheed and Steven Jackson that will come after you on any given night if you allow them to do that. So it's a situation where you just have to earn your respect from them.
I see what you're saying, yeah. I think you have a good story in there. I forget the name of the coach, but one coach was riding you pretty bad in the first game that he had. Next time you were referee and he was the coach, you teed him up like right away as soon as the game started pretty much. Just to send
yeah, that was George Carl.
Yeah.
And he was one of those guys that was real hard and tough on young referees, and until you earned your respect from him, you know, he just rode you all night long. So that's how you basically were able to get them to get off your back, was to issue them a technical foul.
Yeah. It's all sort of described in the book, as you say, the game within the game, which I found just completely fascinating because, like, there's so much more going on there than what, you know, what at first you think is going on. It's really pretty fascinating stuff. Sort of along those lines, it seems like you point out in the book that the younger referees, like the, you know, the coaches sort of zero in on those guys and sort of wear them down over the course of the game, and to the point where they're almost afraid to call fouls at near the end of the game because they've been hearing it from the referee the whole time.
Yeah, it's a situation where, you know, guys like George Carl and Jerry Sloan and Larry Brown are masters at, you know, manipulating young referees and even some of the veteran referees over the years that they're able to, you know, put pressure on and get some calls from. It's a situation where the league office, you know, doesn't allow referees to just tee coaches and players up and throw them out of the game because people pay an enormous amount of money to sit in the stands and see these guys. So it's like, you know, some way you have to survive and get these guys off your back after you give them that first technical foul, because you don't want to be in a position where you're ejecting them and getting some heat from the league office and needing to explain yourself. So sometimes referees will give some calls and marginal calls to some of these players if they're giving them a lot of grief to get them off their back.
The NBA denies it, but it seems like makeup calls are pretty much like a given in any game. Is that fairly accurate, would you say?
Absolutely, and it's kind of insulting to a lot of basketball fans and sports fans that they deny the fact that makeup calls and star treatment don't exist in the NBA, because I think there's an enormous amount of evidence that it certainly does exist.
One of my buddies there who's a big basketball fan, he wanted to know why Rasheed Wallace gets technicals all the time. Is that just because he complains all the time?
I just think that he's one of those guys that is constantly complaining, screaming, and cursing, and thinking that, you know, he's getting, you know, screwed, which, you know, a lot of the referees don't like him, so he is right in a way. He probably gets a little bit less rope than a lot of other people. So, you know, that's probably why.
How were things after the Rasheed run-in? Was it when you refereed games with him after that? Was it still okay? I mean, or was it sort of like tense between the two of you guys?
It was always tense, and you know, it was a situation where I think his first game back, I was the referee, and it was in Philadelphia, and I ended up giving him a technical foul in that game, and Scottie Pippen came off the bench laughing and said that they had taken bets in the locker room to see how quick it would be before I had given him a technical foul, and he kind of thought that it was hysterical.
Let me see. Were there any players that you, aside from Rasheed, were there any players that you had particularly, or owners or coaches that you had particularly difficult time dealing with?
Yeah, I think Jerry Sloan was somebody that was, you know, very difficult to deal with because he liked to you know, scream, yell, and curse at the referees, and for whatever reason, he was he was allowed to take you know, a couple steps further than any other coach was allowed to take in regard to how he, you know, talked to referees. So he was somebody that in my mind was very difficult to deal with.
And now, what about the other guy? The other big name we haven't talked about really is Michael Jordan. What kind of interaction did you have with him? You know, during your days as a referee?
You know, I really didn't have much interaction with him. You know, when he was in the league, he was I was a little bit of a younger referee, and I just try to keep to myself in regard to him. But you know, he was a guy that you know, was definitely someone who played by a different set of rules than a lot of the other players. So I think that's where it all started with all the star treatment.
Yeah, that's what you said earlier. Now, I thought also it was interesting too, just to throw it back to just sort of like, it's almost quaint, the story you share in the book about that you refereed the 3-point contest in the All-Star game and made a bet with, you know, like a league official right there on the court in front of everybody, and, you know, the supervisor was there, and he saw it, and he was laughing about it and everything. So it was like, it wasn't a big deal or something like that.
Yeah, I mean, there was a lot of little things that went on, you know, around the league where, you know, a lot of the referees were betting, or you could see the players betting, you know, on warm-up shots before the game. But it was just, you know, something that was accepted. You know, obviously they didn't think that somebody like myself would become addicted and cross that line that you know, nobody should be near. And unfortunately for me and for the league, you know, that's what happened. But, you know, like I said before, it's hopefully a learning experience for everybody involved, and the NBA can get a lot of things corrected and become bigger and better and stronger than ever before.
And the interesting part about the whole book in general, too, is like once you read this book, first of all, you never really look at the NBA and the NBA games the same way again, but then you wonder how far this sort of culture of bias extends to all the other sports and stuff like that. And it's really quite an eye-opener because I've never heard of any official from any of the big sports sort of like coming out like what happened with you and really sort of like pulling the curtain back on what it's really like there.
Yeah, it is, but I think the problem in the NBA is that the subjectivity is so widespread on what's a foul and what's not a foul that it needs to be closed. That gap is just too big, and it's a situation where certain referees can call certain fouls one way and other referees are calling certain fouls another way, and instead of just enforcing the rules based upon how they're written in the rule book. I think the other sports have you know, a closed gap on that, and that's why the NBA is in a situation where you know, people don't believe a lot of things that they take place and why they're called.
The other thing you mentioned in the book that I thought was really interesting was that the NBA monitors the TV coverage and will call in if they don't like what the announcers are talking about. So I thought that was really remarkable in just the sheer level of control they have over you know, the presentation of the show.
Enormous amount of control. They have somebody that sits in New Jersey and monitors what's said over these national TV telecasts, and if there's something that's you know, being misrepresented or they don't like what's being said, they'll call the truck and have the producer relay a message to the announcers to straighten things out or to you know, not discuss the things that they're discussing. And it's something that they have you know, control on everything that takes place in the league.
Yeah, it's just unbelievable. I guess talk a little bit about sort of like the structure of oversight on these referees, because you know, it's not like there's layers upon layers involved. And then, you know, like when I read your book, David Stern doesn't seem to get involved in the whole story till like the very end when the scandal broke. So it's like it didn't sound like you had much interaction with him at all, you know, leading up to all this. But maybe that's not the case. But I guess talk a little bit about sort of like, you know, the oversight structure there and how involved David Stern was in that and, you know, the actual NBA part of it.
Well, actually, I really only had any conversation with David Stern in meetings at the beginning of the year when he would come in and give a speech to the referees. So what they did is that they had a supervisor of officials and then a lot of group supervisors that would oversee the referees and pass along messages from the league office. So that's where we got our directives from, especially during playoff times when you were in meetings and these group supervisors would come in and discuss with you, wanted to the league office wanted called and show you examples on videotape that either happened in previous games or that happened during the regular season that they wanted controlled and called on any given night. And, you know, like I said before, it was a situation where I was able to determine that it would put one team or another at an advantage or a clear disadvantage. And sometimes the messages were crystal clear and other times they were just subtle. But, you know, I was able to pick up on them and to my disgrace, you know, cross a line that I shouldn't have been near and use that information to place an enormous amount of winning bets on games.
All right, so you're saying sort of like there was the structure of referees and everything and then there was the NBA office. That was sort of like a separate thing and then they sort of used, I guess you could say they were like your bosses or whatever, so they sort of like oversaw all that stuff and then swayed you in different directions as they wanted things to go.
Exactly, because what they would do is they would grade you based on the calls that you made in that game, and if they wanted certain things called in that game and they discussed those things with you during the day, You know, obviously you got a better grade for that game that night, and the goal was to get the best grade you could to advance in the playoffs, and the further you advanced, the more money you made. So obviously you wanted to please those people that ran those meetings because they were the ones that were grading you.
Now, based on the people that you interacted with as far as the other referees and stuff go, and the guys who've been around for a long time, like how long has this culture of bias been in place? You know, is this something that's been going on forever, like, or did it sort of just emerge with the Jordan era or with the Magic Bird era or something like that?
I think it started to emerge with the Jordan era when, obviously, he started to play, you know, with a certain different set of rules than other players were playing with. And I think it just over time evolved, you know, to where every team had that one star player that was given that special treatment every given night that they were on the floor. And I just think it's something that, you know, the referees were trained and programmed and discussed on how to treat certain players differently because of their status. And it evolved into, you know, a point where it just was out of control.
You also share a couple cool sort of like interesting, I guess you could say, little games within the game that the referees played with each other, sort of like who'd hold out longest to give the first foul and who'd give the first technical. I guess talk a little bit about sort of those little games within the games that you guys played for bets and stuff like that.
Yeah, we used to bet $20 a guy on who could hold out the longest in calling a foul to start the game. And you know, we'd throw the ball up and everybody be running up and down the floor and some players would be getting whacked alongside the head and you know, people wouldn't be blowing the whistle because they didn't want to be responsible to pay the ball boy fee for the other two referees. And, you know, we also had little games to where we would bet $20 on who'd be the first person to give somebody like a Rasheed Wallace or a Steven Jackson a technical foul in the game. And it was just little things that we did to add some excitement to the night.
Now, obviously, the players, they had no idea this was going on, right? This wasn't like something where they were like, oh, shit, dude, you playing this game again, man? What the hell? Or anything like that?
No, never at one time did they ever catch on. But I can tell you sometimes to start the game, you know, people would be looking at us like, you know, what the heck's going on out here? I just got fouled, and this guy just got fouled, and nobody's blowing the whistle. So, you know, I'm sure things ran through their mind as to what the heck's going on out here tonight, but never did it ever, you know, become public knowledge as to what we were doing.
Right, right. And it does seem like, you know, up until what happened to you, it does seem like it was sort of like, I guess, an unspoken thing amongst the players and sort of like the people in the league and everything, that there was this culture of bias going on.
No doubt about it. I mean, the players knew that it existed. The coaches knew that it existed, and the owners knew that it existed. So it certainly was not really a hidden secret. I mean, the NBA never would come out and admit it, but you know, you can talk to any retired referee or any you know, body that was a coach in the league and is now not working. It certainly existed, and everybody knew that it did. And it's something that the league certainly needs to straighten out to have the fans feel that, you know, everybody's on an even playing field and every team's on an even playing field. And moving forward, everybody has a fair chance at winning on any given night.
And in the book, when you're talking about Dick Bavetta, and you say that some of the referees went to Michael Jordan's camp, and Michael Jordan was talking about it, and he said that Dick Bavetta cheated, and you sort of raised the rhetorical question of, you know, is it cheating to subtly influence the game so that it's more competitive, or is he really being a company man? I guess I just want to turn those rhetorical questions around on you. I mean, what do you think? Is it cheating, or is it that he's sort of manipulating the game for the excitement of the fans, but at the end of the day, the better team will still win?
Well, I think that's what they hope for, but at times I think it backfires on them. And the right team doesn't win. But it's a situation where the league office knew that certain referees were doing this, and the league office used those referees, you know, in certain playoff games to help make sure that some of these big market teams advanced, or to help make sure that some of these playoff series were extended to a game 5, 6, or 7. So it was no secret that many people knew what he did, even in the league office and other referees. So I think it was just a culture that existed that, you know, it became a form of entertainment. and it just wasn't a true athletic competition. But I'm hoping moving forward with this book and some of the investigation that the FBI did that, things change.
That's the hope, right? I mean, you got to hope that things will get turned around here because it does seem pretty suspect. Although since your story broke, it's like the referees are definitely more under the microscope than ever before.
They are. They are certainly under the microscope. And it's a situation where I think that, the league needs to just let them enforce the rules based on what's in the rule book and not have these subtle messages that they go back and forth game after game after game and not try to change things and allow them to just go out there and call what they see and not referee certain teams or certain personalities. And I think that it would come across as a much fairly officiated contest.
Absolutely, yeah. Now, another referee you talk about in the book who comes up quite a bit is Joey Crawford. So I guess talk a little bit about him and his style of officiating and how, you could use his style of officiating to sort of as a bellwether of the way the game was going to be played out.
Well, I mean, Joe was one of those guys that had a quick temper and didn't take a lot of grief from anybody. And I know when, there was a game to where a certain team got away with doing a lot of things. One night, if he had a game, with that team, soon after that he would take care of business and either, issue some technical fouls and not allow them to embarrass the referees that, a certain team was going to be put at a disadvantage. And, again, it all came down to relationships, positive and negative relationships that existed. And I used those to place winning bets on games.
Well, I know, I thought it was really ironic and interesting that you were the referee at the infamous game, the Malice at the Palace, and the riots that happened and all that. So I guess, share your perspective on what went down there and what it was like to be right in the eye of the hurricane that was that big riot in Detroit.
Yeah, it was certainly a scary moment because, that thing escalated so quick, and it's something that, you never think would happen. And when you talk about fans coming onto the floor and fighting with players and players going into the stands and fighting with fans and there's no way to control it or stop it. It's a very scary thing when chairs are flying and things are flying out of the stands, coins and different things. So it was, definitely a scary moment and hopefully it's something that will never happen again in any professional sporting event.
Yeah. It seems like it just sort of caught fire all of a sudden out of nowhere. That's the way you sort of describe it in the book. Now, when it all went down, what did you do? Just get the hell out of there?
Well, we actually were there for a couple minutes trying to calm things down, but when we knew that it wasn't going to calm down in any way, shape, or form, we certainly all ran for the locker room. So it was definitely a scary moment, but I think we're lucky that none of us was actually hurt.
Now, did you guys catch heat with the league for all that, or was it sort of beyond your control as it is?
No, we did catch a little bit of heat because they felt like we should have stepped in and got between the players a little quicker. And if we would have done that, it's a possibility that it wouldn't have escalated to what it did. But, it's a situation where the league office always has to come down and blame the referees when certain things happen, and that's what they do. There's a lot of things that take place that the league office doesn't support the referees in, because they're basically the necessary evil.
Yeah. Since the whole scandal broke, I know that David Stern sort of put down the order there that people weren't supposed to talk to you or anything like that, but have you heard from any former colleagues or players or coaches or owners or anything like that? I mean, you don't have to name names or anything like that, but have you heard from anybody in the NBA, since all this went down, either thanking you or angry at you for what you did?
No, actually, nobody that was actually angry. I had a couple people that were, in a situation where they read the book and they actually liked the book a lot, and they're hoping that, the book, adds a tremendous amount of change, and it's something that they have discussed with me and said that they don't feel the change is going to happen too quickly because that would be admitting that a lot of things in the book are correct. So well, over a period of time, they're hoping that, the game is begun to be refereed, based on the rules in the rule book and not based on personality or big market teams. And, there's some referees that have been kind of, sliding down the scale of where the NBA had them rated before and seems like they're being pushed out. because, you know, they were kind of exposed to what they had been doing over the years. So I think over time you're going to see some change take place.
Yeah, and one of the interesting aspects, too, about the book is that you sort of, beyond the culture of bias, there's also this sort of culture within the referees and the hierarchy of the referees of sort of like failing upwards. Like the guys who got the jobs as supervisors and stuff were like the mediocre referees, which makes you wonder if that's because they, you know, maybe they were so grateful to keep advancing and everything like that that they were easier to manipulate or something like that. But I guess talk about that culture of failing upwards as far as the referee hierarchy goes.
Yeah, it was very strange that, you know, you had referees that became group supervisors in charge of the on-court referees that basically failed as referees on the floor and were fired after 2 or 3 years. Somehow, some way, they were then rehired and were in charge of giving instruction to referees, you know, during the regular season and during these playoff series. So it was very, very strange how, you know, the whole management system exists in the NBA. And I think it was just a control, you know, situation within the league office that they needed to have people in these positions that they could control and get to pass along messages of what they wanted done.
Next question.
What, Chuck?
I'm sitting here watching the press conference. Nice suit.
Thank you, Chuck. I'm busy right now.
I need some socks. I need them for my footsies. About 6 to 10 pair.
Chuck, I gotta go.
Hey, give me them socks!
You're listening to Banal of America Audio.
Many, many years ago, I was doing a story then for the New York Times on Moses Malone. Moses was shifting from the ABA to the NBA. And my first question was an incredibly intricate question. It went on for 3 to 4 minutes with thousands of clauses.
That's a problem.
And I was trying to get him to be incredibly introspective.
What did he say? What was his answer?
His exact answer to me, which I've remembered for 35 years, was, that's what bees. That's it.
I love that answer.
That's it.
That says it all.